Welcome to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. And today I'm really happy that I'm being joined on today's program by a Health Styles co-producer, Dr. Kenya Beard. And Kenya, good to be with you again, and tell us what we have for today.
Diane, I'm glad to be back. And today we're going to talk about racism and how it intersects with healthcare disparities. I'm really concerned that there continues to be a gap between the best possible type of healthcare that's provided and what is routinely delivered. And that means if both of us entered the emergency room and we both had chest pain, there's a chance that I might not be treated as aggressively as you are. And that's a cause for alarm. You know, unconscious bias or bias that's blatant has no place in healthcare, and we have to have conversations about that. Here to discuss unconscious bias in healthcare is Dr. Augustus White. Dr. White is the Ellen and Melvin Gordon Distinguished Professor of Medical Education, Professor of Orthopedic Surgery at Harvard Medical School, and he was the first African-American graduate of Stanford University's Medical School, and, if that's not enough, the first African-American department chief at Harvard's Teaching Hospital. Today, we will be discussing his experiences that led to the book, Seeing Patients, Unconscious Bias in Healthcare. In his book, he takes on the injustices of bias in medicine. Dr. White, I am so glad to have you on the show. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm very, very happy to be here. And I always welcome the opportunity to talk about this very unconscionable and very difficult problem. Much of it is unconscious, and it's also unconscionable. And they're not just women, but 13 groups of people in our society who experience healthcare disparities simply based on the group that they're in. And certainly the racial angle is a major angle and a very major issue in this difficult problem.
Now, when I saw the title of your book, I thought it was very provocative. Can you tell me what led up to you writing this book?
Well, I've always had interest in issues of equity in terms of diversity issues around education. Even before I was in medical school. And I then subsequently got involved in academic medicine, working in teaching hospitals. And I ended up with a position at our medical school as master of one of their academic societies, which means that for about one-fifth of the total student body and one-fifth of each class, the master is usually a senior professor responsible for helping the medical students in their professional development. And being there put me sort of right in the heart of the Harvard Medical School education program. And this was about 10 years ago that I started this. And it also put me right next to the question of culturally competent care education. That is, that's the antidote, if you will, to healthcare disparities. And
So how can we provide culturally responsive or culturally competent care if we have some type of unconscious bias?
Well, that's a challenge. That is a challenge. That's a human challenge. That's a psychological challenge. It's a political challenge, and it's an important one. And one of the things that I've learned a lot about in terms of looking at this problem is how unconscious is alive and well and active and not at all controlled. And it plays tricks on us in many different venues, one of which is health care. And, of course, as you implied in your introduction, it isn't only unconscious bias that's operative here, but unfortunately, conscious bias is also sometimes in the picture.
So, Dr. White, can I just ask you, I understand you grew up in the South during the Jim Crow era. So that must have very much shaped your beliefs, your perspectives, your experiences. And I wondered if you could share with us some of the experiences that you had that led you to recognize that sometimes the bias is unconscious and that it plays out even among well-intentioned people.
Yes, well, certainly growing up in the South at the time that I did, and in Memphis, which was a very active, engaged, developed black middle class society and culture, and from a very young age, I heard racial anecdotes of all types, many of which were my mother and my aunt sort of standing up for their pride and their intelligence when they were insulted in various ways in that zone. And I sort of grew up hearing about these things, and the other mantra of that middle-class black society was, you know, your education as being very, very important. And, of course, I saw all kinds of examples of bias and racial issues at different stages of my life and my activity.
Logos, what did bias look like back then as compared to now?
Well, one of the things that's fairly dramatic in the book, I talk about a situation. I had the good fortune of being able to work in a hospital, actually as a scrub nurse, in Memphis, in a newly built but segregated all black hospital in Memphis. And since I had been a pre-med student, and it was the summer between medical school and graduating from college, they thought that they could give me sort of on the job training and allow me to work in the operating room as a scrub nurse. And scrub nurse is someone, you're educated. I believe one of you is educated in nursing.
We both are, but our listeners aren't. Yeah. So tell our listeners what a scrub nurse is.
Yeah. Well, you'll appreciate this story, I guess. It's not a nice story. But anyway, I was, so they trained me on the job, and I started. I could pass instruments, and I understood, and I could help the surgeons. And I was doing that with enthusiasm and did it all summer. However, one of the patients that came through was someone who I happened to have known personally. She was the mother of a friend of mine I had grown up with. And she had fairly extensive ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't even a medical student then, but I understood some of the things. Anyway, the doctor who took care of her was a white. All the surgeons in the hospital were white, and most of the doctors were. And he was obviously, seemingly, I mean, I couldn't be in his head, but had no respect for this patient. And was very frustrated and irritated as he took care of her. In fact, as I look at it retrospectively, her tumor and her disease was beyond his capabilities as a surgeon. And probably maybe no surgeon should have been operating her. But certainly, as he went through the procedure, first of all, when she came in the room, said, okay, get on the table. We don't have all day. You know, move over. We've got to get on the operating table. And just was very rude to begin with. So I wasn't surprised at what the surgery looked like as he got into it. And it was as though he just was so frustrated and irritated that he wasn't controlling the bleeding and things were not going well. And the surgery was out of his control. And he was grumbling and swearing and cursing. Of course, she was anesthetized by now. But the disdain and the inhumanity of his relationship was, you know, just blatantly obvious and blatantly racist. And so that really was a real introduction to me around the whole issue of health disparities. Happily, it isn't that bad very often anymore, I don't think. But
so how would you compare what you see today in regards to bias or even unconscious bias in healthcare?
Yeah, well, it varies. It varies tremendously from situations where you mentioned being in the emergency room and not getting as good a workup for your chest pain. Well, also, you wouldn't get to the EMT service wouldn't get you there as fast as your Caucasian counterpart would. That's a study that's been shown that actually women in general experience healthcare disparities. It's not racism, but I guess it's sexism. But there's substantial statistics that show that Caucasian women, as well as other women, experience substantial healthcare disparities, and that includes not getting to the emergency room as fast with the EMT service taking you there. And there are numerous studies that show that they don't get joint replacement surgery as readily, and many of the disparities that exist, women do experience. And of course, there are women, there are African Americans, Asian Americans, Latinos, Native Americans.
Well, that's what I love about your book. You know, when I read it, I said, you don't just talk about, because usually when a person hears bias or prejudice, they automatically think it has to deal with race or that the person is talking about race. And in your book, you talk about bias and prejudice as it relates to class, people who are poor, gender, sexism, like you just said, and even sexual orientation. In fact, there's one page that says, if you're going to have a heart attack, an organ transplant, or a joint replacement, here's the key to getting the very best medical care. Be a white, straight, middle-class male. Now, you made that comment, which was like a real aha, like, okay, it's not just about color. Even someone who, you know, you reference as not being heterosexual.
Yes.
So what might bias look like for them?
Well, it's subtle, and it's difficult to know all the mechanisms, but doctors may not listen as well, may not have empathy to the same degree, may not spend as much time, may not answer the questions as thoroughly as they might, and all of those, and sometimes it's very subtle, and sometimes it's very obvious. And patients will sometimes speak out and should. You know, I encourage patients, if the doctor's taking care of you and things, you know, you feel like they're talking at you or not talking at all or not listening, you should ask them. You know, you should say, doctor, you know, I came here because this clinic or this hospital has a good reputation, but I feel like you're not really paying attention to me or looking. I don't feel like you're taking me, you're going to be able to take care of me. And the doctor will react, and he or she may say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, and if they apologize without making an excuse and say, well, let's try to see, I understand what you're saying, and let's try to see if we can go forward together, work together. And
so I agree with you, Dr. White, that, you know, we have to empower patients to be able to speak up, but the reality is, and I've known from my own family members who I've seen something that was totally inappropriate, and I wanted to raise the issue, and the family member would say, listen, I have to be here when you leave, you know, if they're admitted into the hospital. And there's a fear that they will be treated differently if we speak up. So I try to put the onus on the healthcare provider. So, you know, we have educational standards that say, listen, we have to make sure as faculty that we're graduating a population of healthcare providers who are able to provide culturally responsive care so that they know what they should be doing. So you're an educator. What advice would you give to faculty to help ensure that they graduate future providers who can engage in cross-cultural encounters and identify bias and provide optimal care?
Well, I think it must be education, education, education. And there are many forms of this education now. I mean, different people work on different parts of it. But, for example, we're working on sort of a checklist of idea, kind of an approach for, and I agree with you, clearly it should be focused on the caregiver, although I still believe it's helpful to have the patient coached to some degree also, for example, be reminded of their rights. Patients are entitled legally and ethically to good care. But anyway, back to your question. I think teaching people about, first of all, have them know that these disparities exist. I mean, there's still a lot of doctors that say, "Oh, I don't know what you're talking about. I take good care of all my patients." So first of all, know that it exists. Know that unconscious bias is a reality, and know that conscious bias is a reality. And know that if you believe that it is a reality and you clearly want to provide equitable care as a professional, and I think one of the things that resonates best in my experience in talking to doctors, maybe some of whom aren't so much excited and happy to be dealing with this, is to try to appeal to their professionalism. I think, you know, most doctors down inside of them, I think, want to feel like they're professional, caregiving, capable, doing a good job, humanitarian people. And, you know, I understand, you know, that there's that doctor that I was in the operating room with. He certainly wouldn't fit that description. But I think that is helpful. So I think it's part of their professional responsibility and to provide them with the knowledge, skills, and attitudes that will indeed allow them to be successful as they develop their professional style and their professional skills and attitudes. I think that can be approached.
So let me just pause for a moment and remind listeners that you're listening to Health Styles on WBAI 99.5 FM New York. I'm Diana Mason. I'm here with Dr. Kenya Beard, co-producer of Health Styles, and we're talking with Dr. Augustus White, the Ellen and Melvin Gordon Distinguished Professor of Medical Education and Professor of Orthopedic Surgery at the Harvard Medical School. He's also the author of the book Seeing Patients, Unconscious Bias in Healthcare. And we're talking today about bias in healthcare, and as you're talking, I'm reflecting on last week a conversation that I had with a diabetes nurse practitioner colleague of mine, who told me how she was just really taken aback when a patient with diabetes who is gay said he wanted a referral to a gay endocrinologist. And so and this was the first time she had this kind of request. And as we're talking, you know, as we think sometimes patients don't recognize all the biases that are inherent in healthcare, and yet I think they do. I think that request probably came from probably years of treatments differentially, or the patient feeling like, I can't really reveal who I am and myself. And I'm sure that also plays out for people of color, for people who are poor, feeling like, I'm not sure that I can trust being transparent and truthful and share what's on my mind with this person they will not understand. So I'm interested in, how would you coach a patient if we think that we are not biased in healthcare, and there are very few would probably say, oh, I know I'm biased, how do we have these conversations with patients?
Well, I have, I'm glad you asked that. We just published an article called Some Advice for Minorities and Women on the Receiving End of Healthcare Disparities. And it's published in the Journal of Racial and Ethnic Health Disparities in 2014, Volume 1, page 61 to 66. And it's under their section called Perspective. It's a perspective article. But by the way, that's a relatively new journal, it's published by Springer. It started by an African-American orthopedic colleague of mine, actually, Cato Lorenzen. The advice is a series of about 15 bullets. It starts with kind of an introduction, just a very brief introduction of background and the fact that these biases exist. And then it goes into some things, much of which you already know as a nurse, but it says, first of all, become as health literate as you can. Learn about your disease, read about your disease, take a friend or relative with you to the encounter. Fill out the patient forms for evaluation of your treatment. Mm-hmm. We mentioned know your rights as a patient, do a kind of a teach back exercise if you can, just as you're leaving. If the physician doesn't use it, we recommend that the caregivers use it as well, physicians and nurses. Just ask Ms. Jones, just as we finish up, can you give a sense of how you see your problem and what we're doing about it? Mm-hmm. And if she gets it right, you say, that's right. And if not, you make the additions and our corrections. Another thing we emphasize is to encourage the patient to actually, I call it trying to humanize your doctor. Mm-hmm. And that is, you can't get into any intimate relationship necessarily, but some common humanity that you can experience so that the doctor recognizes you and you, the doctor, as human beings, because that's part of the importance of the interaction. And the weather, you talk about the weather. You guys asked me about the weather when we first started. Everybody experiences the weather, and you can have not a long conversation, but just a brief conversation, something about sports or whatever, but make some attempt to reach out. And we even suggest maybe just look. A lot of doctors, you can get a little bio sketch before you go in. Mm-hmm. And now we're working on kind of a mirror image of this. That is, we're working on an article now with the same title, except it says caregivers, advice to caregivers who are at risk of providing inequitable care. Mm-hmm. And, here's some things that we recommend that you do, that you encounter the patient. It's kind of a checklist. And just a reminder to do these things, and I think operatively, and of course answer, as we mentioned already, answer the questions. But operatively, I think this goes a long way in terms of facilitating tending to diminish some of the problems that may exist, that do exist in this very complicated relationship.
So if I went to you and I feel like I was treated in a biased way, either as a woman or as a person of color or because of my sexual orientation, what would you advise me to do? Should I say something to the provider? Should I just not go back to that provider? What would be, other than filling out the evaluation when that opportunity arises, what would you do?
Well, I would encourage you to bring it up and say, as I mentioned earlier, doctor, I came here because of your reputation and I was referred to you, but somehow I really don't feel right. I don't think we're making any kind of progress. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason it's good to do that is, one, I don't know the percentages, but some doctors will try to correct it, and they'll want to keep you there. Mm-hmm. Even if they don't, if it's just in their head and not in their heart, they may want to keep you. And if they respond in a way that convinces you of that, then I would stay with them. But if they blow you off, mm-hmm. then the proof is in the pudding.
They reflect on what the patient says, and they don't take it as something that's negative, and they really try to work with the patient to identify what it is that they do see when they
exactly.
take that patient and try to, identify what their own bias is and remedy it. Dr. White, thank you so much. I mean, you really gave us a good picture of what bias in healthcare looks like and some of the steps to really try to eliminate those biases. And patients, yes, they have to feel empowered that they can speak up. But more importantly, as providers, we have to make sure that we're trying to form good relationships with our patients that respect their beliefs, their values, and who they are. And Diana, what did you want to say?
Well, I wanted to just ask you, who's your audience for your book? Were you writing this for the public or for healthcare workers?
Both. And I can answer another way. I would say I was writing it for my fellow human beings.
Yes.
I've been pleased with the diversity of positive responses, that is, from whence they come. It's interesting to me how much the broad variety of different people who relate to some part of, not the whole thing, obviously, yeah. but some part of it that people can really identify with. And as I said, it's been pretty broad, you know, in terms of ethnicity and in terms of gender and in terms of professions and all.
And I'm assuming it's available on Amazon.com?
Yes.
So the book is Seeing Patients, Unconscious
Patient.
Patient. Say it again.
Seeing Patients, plural. You were right.
Yeah, Unconscious Bias in Healthcare.
Yes, Seeing Patients, Unconscious Bias in Healthcare. The author is our guest today, Dr. Augustus White. He's the Ellen and Melvin Gordon Distinguished Professor of Medical Education and Professor of Orthopedic Surgery at Harvard Medical School. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the privilege. I've enjoyed this, and I really appreciate your interest, and I wish you well in your endeavor to change this.
Yes. Well, I want to give a shout out here to my colleague Dr. Kenya Beard. She is doing a whole series of programs on disparities in healthcare, and I think it's a very important topic to be covering because the disparities are still there, and we have to do something about it. So, Kenya, thank you for your work as well, and for producing this program today. And
oh, you're welcome.
We're going to be taking a brief break and come right back and continue the conversation, talking more about how to have these crucial conversations. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of Health Styles. Health Styles is brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. That's centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. You're listening to Health Styles on WBAI 99.5 FM New York. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. And today I'm joined by my colleague, co-producer, Dr. Kenya Beard, and we're talking about racism in healthcare. And Kenya, what do we have now for the second half of today's program?
Diana, for the second half, we're going to look at ways to engage in crucial conversations around racism in an attempt to really decrease healthcare disparities. You know, there have been recent acts of racism in the African-American community, and they've sparked some pretty courageous dialogues about racism in healthcare. Now, two articles come to mind. One was written about 2 years ago in the American Nurse Today. It was titled Confronting Racism in Healthcare. And Dr. Cipriano, she's the author, she asked back then, what should be the responsible conversation about race in healthcare? And now fast forward to 2 months ago, Dr. Mary Bassett, she's our New York City's health commissioner, she wrote an op-ed piece in the New England Journal of Medicine called Hashtag Black Lives Matter, A Challenge to the Medical and Public Health Communities. In this article, she stated there needs to be a critical dialogue and action on issues of racism in health, lest we risk maintaining the status quo. And she said that because medical students were asking her, after they staged a sit-in, what more can they do to move the needle closer towards social justice? So how do we have those courageous conversations? Usually, you know, when you hear the R word, it's oftentimes a word that can trigger a lot of emotion and controversy. Talks can get pretty heated. And some people rather just not talk about racism. So here to answer the question, how do we engage in safe conversations, is Dr. Kimberly Richards from the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. Dr. Richards is a mom of three. She's raising three black men. She has her doctoral degree from the University of Pittsburgh on policy planning for policy planning and evaluation. And Dr. Kimberly Richards, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Dr. Beard. Thank you, both you and Dr. Mason.
So, Kimberly, tell me, your organization seeks to build an effective movement for social transformation and undo racism. What does that mean, undo racism?
Yes. First, let me give you a little bit of background on our organization. Again, we are the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. We are a group of anti-racist organizers. We are multiracial, multicultural, and multi-ethnic. We're founded by our executive director, Ronald Chisholm, and the late Dr. James Norman Dunn, two African-American men who were really a part of the civil rights movement. You know, Dr. Dunn was activated to really organizing after Emmett Till's murder. Ron was activated in the organizing around seeing police brutality in New Orleans in the Treme community. And they realized that in a lot of the organizing that had happened, that we really did not have a way, have a language, or a common definition to really talk about race and racism, and more importantly, to do our organizing to undo it. So for us, what it means to undo racism is, number one, we have to look at, we have to understand, and we have to be able to define what has been done. So we analyze the history of the racialization process. Because, Dr. Beard, we did not come to this country or were not brought to this country as black people. And those in your listening audience who are white did not come here or were not brought here as white. That the racialization process is a dehumanizing process. That I'm sure some of your listeners, their ancestors were Italian, were Irish, were Igbo, were Fulani, were Hausa. And so that process of being reduced to white or to black, or Hispanic, or Latino, or even Asian, we identify that process as a lumping, dehumanizing process. So we first, to undo it, have to acknowledge and recognize and have a common language and a common definition on what was done. And then,
so what do you mean, what has been done? How do you define what has been done?
We define that by really looking at the institutional, historical structure of the codification process of race. That, you know, we define race as a specious classification system. So a number of things were done, i.e. edicts from the Pope, i.e. laws. You know, the very first act of Congress of the United States government was to define who could be a citizen. And, you know, that's when we see white legally used, you know, and knowing that women don't have the same access to power as men. But it didn't say white men. It said white people. So we are a nation. Dr. Francis Quest Welsing says if you take the letters that we use to spell America and you scramble those letters up, you will get the phrase, I am race. So what was done is that a nation, an ideology was created and imposed on every one of our institutions that has the principle and the value and the concept of race and racialized peoples. So that's what was done.
So I can understand that's what happened way back when, but I'm sure our listeners want to know, why does racism still exist then?
Well, that's because, you know, the short answer is that it's because it has not been undone. The long answer is that the ideology was imposed and imprinted on every one of our institutions.
How so?
Well, one, we have internalized a value that says who is most valuable, who is most important, which is why we have a lot of young organizers and not-so-young organizers coming together around Black Lives Matter. Because, you know, as our capitalist system has evolved out of the stealing of native land and the stealing of African peoples, that our economic system was built on an ideology that produced wealth, which is why we still have racism today, because it's very profitable. And so where we were not maybe alive when it was constructed, we still live in that house. And
so how would we say that racism is profitable in healthcare?
Well, one of the ways that racism is profitable in healthcare, when we look at all of the sickness that is, you know, in our nation as a whole, and how there are disparate outcomes in the African American community and other communities of color, that, you know, I look right here in New Orleans, where we have seen HIV and AIDS and other infectious diseases in some communities are on the decline. I mean, the African-American community are on the incline, they're on the increase. And with that increase comes a number of health and human services to address the needs of that community. And we find all sorts of federal, all sorts of private, all sorts of foundation money going to address racial health disparities. But until we're really able to talk about racial health disparities, because now it benefits health care to just talk about health disparities, because what that does is not point us to understanding race and racism. And if we don't understand what it is and how it functions, then it will continue to produce disparate outcomes that will keep many of us working, tinkering around the edges and continuing to secure money for it, but we're really not getting to the root causes of why we have the disparities that we do.
So, Kimberly, one of the things that we're trying to do in healthcare is to diversify the workforce so that we can have the perspectives of a multicultural group of individuals that can help develop policies so that we can end healthcare disparities. Are you saying that we're in the right direction or we're still not there?
Diversifying the workforce is important, and we applaud efforts that you and others are doing to make sure that there are more people who are providing services who look like the people who are receiving services. That is utmost important. What we would also say is that if we stop there and don't understand, because many efforts to be culturally diverse or culturally competent rarely studies white culture. And if we say that we value diversity and we really don't look at white organizational culture and what it is that we're diversifying and what the world views of the people who are being brought into the health profession or any profession, we are still not addressing different worldviews. We're not addressing how white culture is seen as the norm or as the standard. And so that is a step in what we say, that cultural competency and cultural diversity efforts have to look at worldviews of all cultural groups, Europeans as a cultural group, African, Asians, and Latinos as a cultural group, Asians as a cultural group, and Native Americans as a cultural group. And how do those cultural groups and their value systems and their ways of knowing and their pedagogy and their process, how are they equally valued in the workplace?
Okay. So, Diana, you wanted to add something?
Yes, let me just remind listeners that you're listening to Health Styles, and I'm here with Dr. Kenya Beard, and we're talking with Dr. Kimberly Richards, who is an anti-racist organizer with the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. And we're talking about racism in healthcare, and we're going to be talking about how to have the crucial conversations about healthcare, or about racism, and particularly I'm interested in how do we do this in healthcare settings. But before we do that, I'm very interested, Kimberly, in your thoughts about the connection between racism and poverty. You know, when we look at what went on in Baltimore and some of the demonstrations that went on, some of the burning that went on, etc. People were taught, and the killing that went on. The people point out that indeed Baltimore has been a city of stark disparities income wise, as well as racial disparities. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts, or if the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond are also making the link between racism and income disparities.
Absolutely, Dr. Mason. What we do is we do a 2.5-day workshop, and the foundation of that workshop to help people understand race is to first understand class. And so we build a race analysis by first developing a class analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And once we develop a solid class analysis, we move forward in pointing toward race by, number one, helping people understand that glue in this country that holds class in place.
Yes. Because
if we were able to just say it was only class, that we would see more sustainable movements that bring poor people together across race lines.
Yeah.
And what we have historically seen in this country, that, well, number one thing that we've seen is that we have been very socialized and we have been very conditioned to equate poverty and race. Yet there are more poor white people in America based on sheer numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you don't see the same kind of systemic oppression, not minimizing the oppression that poor white people suffer in any way.
Mm-hmm.
But what we also say is that when you add race to that oppression, the impact doubles.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we are very clear that the race analysis is used to hold and maintain the class structure that we have.
So
Kimberly, you once said also that messages reinforce racism.
Yes.
What did you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is messages that are a part of our common conversation, that flood the media, that when children see images of all of the people who are smart, all the people who are in business, who are wealthy, who are making contributions that are framed in a positive light, as predominantly white, and when, and it's not just children, but when human beings see messages that have the image, even the image of a welfare mom, you know, that we have been socialized to hear welfare queen and see someone who looks like me or another African-American woman as opposed to a white woman, whereas the reality is that based on sheer numbers, there are more poor white women on welfare in America than anyone else. But we are not, we don't receive that message in the media.
Mm-hmm.
We also don't receive the message of, you know, of the diversity of brilliance, that brilliance is, or that criminality is not just, you know, relegated to predominantly one race. We also get messages in, you know, whenever you add white to something, it elevates it. You know, white lie, white collar criminal. Yet when you add black to anything, you know, it's black bald, it's black listed, you know, it's black market.
A lot of negative connotations.
A lot of negative connotations that then are reinforced in the media, are reinforced in the education system, you know, and then reinforced by the healthcare system.
Right, and we saw that play out a couple of weeks ago with the word thug.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested in how do we have these conversations, and I'll share with you that several months ago, I was with a younger member of my family, my extended family, and we were talking about, he had followed me on Facebook, and I had posted the writing of an African-American woman who was talking about her experience on an Amtrak train as she was going to New York to do a teach-in at New York University, and she was talking about this white man who moved the bag on her seat. She had her ear, you know, headset in on listening to music and was looking out the window, so she didn't see, she just saw this hand come across. And it was a writing about how a black man would never touch the purse of a white woman if you reverse the situation. I was very surprised that this member of my family, who's, you know, young adult, in his 30s, started talking about reverse racism and that it didn't present the man's point of view. His experience was that there is a lot of reverse racism going on. And so we were having, I was sort of appalled, and we were having this conversation, and I thought, my gosh, if I'm having this much difficulty talking to this member of my family about this, what happens when we go into our workplaces and try to have a conversation about the bias that we're seeing and about the racism that we're experiencing? And when there is somebody talking, well, reverse racism is more of a problem than racism, what do we do with this? How do we have these conversations?
You know, that's a phenomenon that we're finding as well, where when people don't have a common definition and common language, that it can result in conversations that are heated and don't really go very far. Because we use so many words interchangeably with racism, that we use implicit bias or bias, bigotry, prejudice, discrimination, hate, that all those words are used, prejudice, in ways that we assume they mean the same thing, and yet they don't. And so we oftentimes miss each other in communication, because it's like in many ways we're speaking two different languages. So what we have found that really assists in having a conversation, you know, with loved ones, with family members in the workplace, with other activists and organizers, is to, one, you know, we work to help people get on the same page. First around, we're going to really listen to each other. We're going to respect each other. We're going to realize that we come from different worldviews and different perspectives, and we're going to struggle. And we set an environment where people also understand that comfort and safety are not the same thing, that many times we're socialized to just want to be comfortable in a conversation.
Right.
And we'll say that we want to be, that we don't feel safe. Well, through our dialogue, it's an opportunity for folks to really know that everyone's humanity and human dignity will be honored, but there will be some uncomfortable spaces, because we enter a conversation, you know, we all get uncomfortable when we get to a place, you know, we're comfortable with what we know, and then we start getting uncomfortable when we know that there are things that we don't know, and we start learning them, and then we find out that there are things that we don't even know that we don't know, and then that last point is where people really get heated in conversations, is when they learn that what they think they know is actually not so. And so we create an environment where people realize that you are going to experience all four of those steps in your process to have a common language and a common definition. And that then through the process, we really help people to understand that the racialization process, again, is a dehumanizing process. All of us, as human beings, have been dehumanized by the fact that we've been racialized. Yet,
how so?
Well, I mean, how
when you say all of us.
Okay, well, so, you know, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, where I watched a young man go from being Czech and very deeply rooted in his culture to just being white. And so, you know, we are socialized to believe that, you know, Europeans came here to the land of milk and honey, where the streets were paved with gold. But the process of becoming white and becoming American was a very difficult process. That upwards of 40% of Italians, there's a wonderful book called Strangers on a Different Shore by Ronald Takaki. He talks about the assimilation process and the Americanization process was a very hard, dehumanizing process. That, you know, New York's history, you know, of signs saying, you know, no dogs or Irish allowed. So the process of becoming white meant that for Europeans who were coming to this country for a better life and a better world, that many of them gave up their language. Many of them, their names were changed. Many of them, they, you know, gave up the cultural mores and folkways of, quote-unquote, the old country. That is dehumanizing.
Okay.
Culture humanizes us. You know, and many of us as African Americans, you know, we do DNA ancestry work to try to find, you know, what village or what, you know, what nation of people that we actually come from. And, you know, we seek, you know, Maria Ani has written about let the circle being broken. We, you know, traditions from various villages and you know, tribal groups, you know, have worked to be that weed that comes through the concrete. But many of us don't know. You know, many of us have been able to find, but many, many more, you know, so we have been, you know, disconnected from our cultural heritage and tradition, and that is dehumanizing.
Right. Good point. You know, we don't have much time left, but I wanted to ask you, if you had to just sum up two or three steps that we'd have to take to undo unconscious racism, what would those steps look like?
One step would be to be able to have the conversation about race and racism itself. You see, so many of our systems have just cut race off. The education system says the achievement gap, when it's a racial achievement gap. You know, the healthcare system, I applaud many of you in healthcare. I remember when the New England Journal of Medicine came out back in the 90s, the mid-90s, around race being the independent variable in health outcomes. But we saw a process of racial and ethnic disparities be dropped off, and we now just say health disparities.
Okay, so bring back the racism word.
We have to be able to bring back the racism word, and we have to be able to bring it back in a way that when the healthcare field has a common definition, just as you have a common definition of what diabetes is, just as you have a common definition of what hypertension or cardiovascular, that if we're going to address the racial and ethnic health disparities, that the profession and all professions have to have a common definition. We pride ourselves in healthcare on defining and diagnosing. And diagnosis will determine treatment, correct?
That's right.
So we have to be able to diagnose what race and racism is. We have to have that be a common, you know, we in this nation, we have a common standard now of what, you know, although it changes, but we know what high cholesterol is. You know, it went from, what, 200 to now it's, what, 170?
Say it again. It's,
you know,
what?
We have a common definition of what, you know, a normal cholesterol level is. We have a range.
Oh, definitely, right.
Right? And
a target level that we're trying to get people to and what's abnormal. Definitely.
Right. So we have to be able to, just as we have a range of cholesterol or a range of what good blood pressure is, that is a common standard, we also have to have a common definition of what race is and what racism is and how it is showing up in our institutions. So once we have that common standard, then we can be able, I think, to start addressing unconscious racism, because we first have to consciously address what racism is.
Kimberly,
okay, so I hear you.
Can you tell us very quickly about how people can get more information about this topic and about the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond?
Absolutely. Thank you. We do a lot of work in New York. We do our 2.5 day, some places it's 2 days, some places it's 2.5 days, but we do a number of them in New York, and you can check out our website. We have two. The workshops in New York, we have a People's Institute Northeast, and one of the organizing entities in the People's Institute Northeast is called the Anti-Racist Alliance. And the Anti-Racist Alliance has a website, and it is antiracistalliance.com. On that website, you can go and you can find out when there are workshops in the New York area or in the Northeast. Our national organization, the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond, based in New Orleans, Louisiana, our website is PISAB, People's Institute Survival and Beyond.org. And there you can find where we're offering workshops and where you can call us and talk to us about ways that you want to at least start this conversation in your organization or in your health care office.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Kimberly Richards, for joining us on Health Styles today. It's been a fascinating conversation. I feel like we could talk all day about this, and I would encourage listeners to go to that website if you're in the Northeast area to look at workshops that may be available to help you have these conversations. Go to www.antiracistalliance.com. or go to the website of the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond at PISAB.org. Thank you so much, Dr. Richards.
Thank you very much, Dr. Beard and Dr. Mason. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
And thank you to Kenya for producing this Health Styles program today. It's been a fascinating discussion, and thank you for your continued work on this area. Dr. Kenya Beard is one of the producers of Health Styles, and her focus is on health disparities, racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare. And we're also doing some work on income disparities with Richard Doherty, who is a graduate student at Hunter College. So we're confronting some of these longstanding issues and hoping that listeners will take note and that we can move these conversations forward. I'm Diana Mason. I'm one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. That's centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. You've been listening to Health Styles on WBAI 99.5 FM New York. Have a great afternoon.